Apples, they had finally settled on the Apaches as a name that conveyed their bold fearlessness. Or bloodthirsty murderousness, Mr. Swift said. Roman conquers, Augustus explained further. There was a murmur of interest from the Apaches. Every autumn the playing fields of their school became the battleground for the annual Conquer Wars, a particularly savage form of warfare that inevitably ended with several of the injured in Matron's office. Mr. Robinson had been invited to dinner by Mr. and Mrs. Swift, along with the vicar, who was the genial, slightly confused sort of vicar that was very common in the area, and Miss Slee, a forthright, rather mannish spinster, whose weekend hobby was rambling.
"Rambling?" Augustus said scornfully to his parents. "How is that a hobby? You're always saying to me, 'Stop rambling on, Augustus,' and then..."
He tugged on the imaginary lapels of an imaginary barrister's gown.
"And then you say, 'Why don't you get a sensible hobby, Augustus?'"
Also sipping the Swift sherry were Mr. and Mrs. Brewster, who were new to the village, and Colonel Stewart, who was generally disagreeable to all and sundry, and had a particular dislike of small boys.
"A soiree," Mrs. Brewster exclaimed when invited. "How charming!"
Mrs. Brewster cut a rather striking figure. She was tall, with a head of impressive red curls, and a rather theatrical manner. She was very keen on amateur dramatics, apparently.
"Not just the Romans," Mr. Brewster said, eyeing the near-empty sherry decanter anxiously. "Angles, Saxons, Vikings, Normans. It's been one invading horde after another."
The Brewsters were new money, according to Miss Carlton, a shrew-faced elderly spinster who eyed Mr. Brewster eyeing the decanter. She was a teetotaler, which seemed to make her rather irritable. She had induced Augustus and the rest of his little tribe to sign a pledge that they would never partake of alcohol in exchange for a halfpenny worth of lemon sherbets.
"Fair trade," the Apaches were agreed.
Bringing up the rear at the soiree was the Swifts' next-door neighbour, Mrs. Garrett.
"Previously," Mr. Robinson said, holding forth again, "we had only been able to date ourselves back to Doomsday."
"Doomsday," Augustus murmured to himself appreciatively. "Day of doom." He was much taken by words that seemed to hold within them the promise of almost infinite mayhem. His eavesdropping was rudely interrupted by Cook knocking him on the head with a soup spoon, her preferred weapon, and shooing him away.
"That boy lurks," he had heard her complaining to their housemaid, Mavis. "He's a regular little spy."
Augustus felt rather gratified by this compliment. Naturally, he was going to be a spy when he grew up, as well as a pilot, a train driver, an explorer, and a collector of things. "What kind of things?" Mrs. Swift had asked at the breakfast table that morning, and immediately regretted the question, as Augustus launched into an enthusiastic list that included mouse skeletons, gold farthings, mollusks, twine, diamonds, and glass eyeballs.
"I've never heard of gold farthings," Mr. Swift said.
"That's why I'll collect them. They'll be worth a king's ransom."
"What if they don't exist?" Mr. Swift said.
"Then they'll be worth even more."
"Did you drop him on his head when he was a baby?" Mr. Swift asked Augustus's mother.
Mrs. Swift muttered something that sounded like, "I wish I had," and added much louder,
"Do stop fiddling with the marmalade pot, Augustus."
"Go away," Cook said to him.
She was still in high dudgeon over the Charlotte Russe she had planned for dessert, which was what they ate when they had guests. When they didn't have guests, it was simply pudding. Augustus said it wasn't his fault that he had eaten all the sponge finger biscuits. He had been going to take just one, and then somehow, when he looked again, they had all gone. How did that happen? How did it happen so often? To Cook's chagrin, the Charlotte Russe had been demoted into a more banal mousse.
"What will they think?" she grumbled.
"They'll think they're jolly lucky,"
Augustus said, under the understandable misapprehension that moose was moose, which sounded like a more exciting item of food than the usual fare served up at the Swifts' dining table. Indeed, moose was the kind of prey that the Apaches might hunt with their bows and arrows before spit-roasting it over a campfire. Augustus's own bow and arrow were currently confiscated due to an unfortunate incident. "There are no moose in this country," Mr. Swift pointed out.
"How do you know," Augustus said, "if you've never seen one?"
"You have the makings of a fine empiricist," his father had told him, after a particularly challenging discussion about cricket balls and greenhouse glass. "But if you didn't see who threw the ball, then how could you know it was me?"
"Because it's always you," Mr. Swift said wearily.
Mrs. Garrett clapped her hands suddenly and said,
"A pageant."
Augustus had returned to loitering. A soup spoon was no deterrent to an Apache.
"We should have a pageant to celebrate the village's history."
The assembled company were in voluble agreement.
"It would depict the whole history of Britain as experienced from the point of view of a typically English village," Mrs. Garrett infused.
"I myself," Mrs. Brewster said, "have played several queens in theatrical productions."
Mrs. Swift murmured something inaudible.
"But none of those awful boys must be in it," Colonel Stewart said.
"Oh, goodness, no, I quite agree," Miss Carlton said. "Oh, I'm sorry," she said hastily to Mr. Swift. "One of them is yours, isn't he?"
"Well," Mr. Swift demurred, "we found him on the front doorstep, actually."
Augustus frowned at this paternal betrayal. There were sympathetic murmurs all round. Mrs. Swift said agreeably, "Of course we didn't. It was the back doorstep." There was much laughter at this remark. Augustus's frown deepened. Had he been found on a doorstep? Front or back seemed irrelevant. He was an abandoned orphan. He was rather pleased with that idea. Perhaps his real parents were incredibly rich and had been hunting for him ever since accidentally leaving him on Mr. and Mrs. Swift's doorstep.
"Oh, I'm sure we can find something for all the children to do," Mrs. Garrett said.
Mrs. Garrett was a somewhat troubling figure in Augustus's world. Until recently, she had been merely the rather stout and friendly widow who lived next door. She was fond of children, an unusual trait in a grown-up, and had a very good greenhouse full of peaches and grapes that the Apaches were always attempting to raid, to the fury of her gardener. She was also generous with sweets and cakes, again an unusual habit in a grown-up. But, unfortunately, she was also the leader of the local chapter of Afor Arod. The words were Saxon, according to Mrs. Garrett, for fierce and bold, which none of the members were. If you could imagine a scout pack consisting of only the outcasts and rejects of boyhood society, then that would be Afor Arod. The goody-goodies, the fat, the toadies, the swats, and girls. They were a peace-loving alternative to the rather militaristic scouts, according to Mrs. Garrett, who was a stalwart of the Peace Pledge Union.
"Cooperation and harmony," she said.
Augustus's mother thought this would be good for Augustus, as these were traits that he was singularly lacking.
"Not true," he protested. "Look at the Apaches."
"Quite," Mrs. Swift said,
and dragged him along to a meeting. This was so unfair, he thought bitterly, as he watched a group of children dancing in a circle. Dancing? No one had mentioned dancing.
"Oh, a new friend for us," Mrs. Garrett declared, as if she had never seen him before, when in fact she encountered Augustus on an almost daily basis.
And then Augustus met his nemesis. He spied a little girl in the corner of the room, a little girl with the curliest curls and the sweetest dimples.
"Madge, hello."
She was doing some kind of sewing.
"Cross-stitch, a badge.
Would you like me to make you one, Augustus?"
Augustus nodded dumbly, looking even more idiotic than usual. And now he lived in horror that the rest of the Apaches would catch him in the midst of any of the Afor Arod's ghastly pastimes— the aforesaid dancing and sewing, the chanting and poetry writing. Nature walks, which, it turned out, did not mean the raiding of birds' nests or the indiscriminate shooting at things with catapults. No, mayhem, in fact. The whole thing was odious, but he was helplessly in thrall to Madge.
Oh, thank you for helping me wind my wool, Augustus.
A pageant, he reported back to the Apaches. Invading hordes, he added.
He moved a pear drop from one cheek to the other, a movement that generally signalled deep thought.
Got an idea, he said casually. If we...
Oh, do stop,
Teddy said to Ursula.
He's nothing like you, you know,
his sister said, laughing.
I know that, Teddy said. But please stop reading now.
Author's note. When I first decided that I wanted to write a novel set during the Second World War, I rather grandiosely believed that I could somehow cover the whole conflict in less than half the length of War and Peace. When I realized this was too daunting a challenge for both reader and writer, I chose the two aspects of the war that interested me most, and which I thought provided the richest material, the London Blitz and the strategic bombing campaign against Germany. Life After Life is about Ursula Todd and what she goes through during the Blitz, while A God in Ruins, I like to think of it as a companion piece rather than a sequel, is about Ursula's brother Teddy and his life as a Halifax pilot in Bomber Command. Neither novel is exclusively about the war. Indeed, in both novels, we spend a long time either arriving at the outbreak of hostilities or an equally long time dealing with the aftermath. Nonetheless, it is Ursula's and Teddy's individual and shared experiences of the war that permeate their lives. Ursula lived many versions of her life in the previous novel, which gave me a certain freedom when it came to Teddy's own life, many of the details of which are different in this book. I like to think of A God in Ruins as one of Ursula's lives, an unwritten one. This sounds like novelist trickery, as indeed it perhaps is, but there's nothing wrong with a bit of trickery. Teddy captains a Halifax, and so it goes almost without saying that he is stationed in Yorkshire, where most of the Halifax airfields were situated. The Lancaster gets all the glamour and glory. I would refer you to Teddy's grumbles on this subject rather than mine. Teddy's Halifax is part of Bomber Command No. 4 Group, one of two groups based in Yorkshire. The other was No. 6 Group, the RCAF. I have not tied Teddy down to a named airfield or squadron in order to allow myself a little authorial latitude. I imagined him, however, as part of 76 Squadron, and I used the squadron's operational records in the National Archives when it was based either at Linton-on-Ouse or at home on Spalding Moor as a guide for his war. I read many vivid first-hand accounts of individual aircrews' experience to which I am indebted, histories and accounts that draw on personal experiences as well as the more official histories. The stories of the men who served in Bomber Command are all extraordinary, documenting as they do not only the prized virtue of stoicism, but a heroism and determination and modesty that seem almost alien to us nowadays, although of course we have not been tested the way they were. The average age of these men, boys really, all volunteers, was 22. They experienced some of the worst combat conditions imaginable, and fewer than half of them survived. Of aircrew flying at the beginning of the war, only 10% would see the end of it. One cannot fail to be moved by the sacrifice of their lives, and I suppose that was what first impelled me to write this novel. There is nothing that happens during the chapters set during the war in A God in Ruins that isn't in some way based on a real-life incident that I came across in the course of my research. Even the most horrific, even the most outlandish, although nearly always modified in some way. It is sometimes difficult to remember that you are writing fiction, not history, as it is only too easy to get caught up in the finer and not so finer technicalities. But the needs of the novel should always trump one's own peculiar obsessions. The Bristol Hercules engine became mine, but that, too, I handed on to Teddy. I readily admit to borrowing from everyone, but particularly from a harrowing account of ditching in Geoffrey Jones's Raider, when, in January 1944, the unnamed crew of Halifax 2 JD-165, S. Sugar, from 102 Ceylon Squadron based at Pocklington, spent 3 days adrift in the North Sea on their return from a raid on Berlin. I also learned a lot about what it was like to be caught in a thunderstorm from Keith Lowe's Inferno. I fudged a few things, the date of the introduction of those darn Bristol engines for a start, and for the most part ignored the continual developments in technical and navigational aids, so that the reader wasn't continually tripping over heavy-handed references to, for example, HS2, Fishpond or Monica all the time. Some things I haven't explained, for the same reason, but also because I haven't necessarily understood them myself. Best to be honest here, I think. The bottom line is that it's fiction. Personally, I think that all novels are not only fiction, but they are about fiction too. Not, I don't think, as postmodernly self-referential as it sounds. I get tired of hearing that a new novel is experimental, or it reinvents the form, as if Lawrence Stern or Gertrude Stein or indeed James Joyce never wrote a word. Every time a writer throws themselves at the first line of a novel, they are embarking on an experiment, an adventure. I believe in the rich textural and textual interplay of plot, character, narrative, theme and image, and all the other ingredients that get thrown in the pot. But I don't believe that necessarily makes me a traditionalist, as if we're not all in a tradition, the tradition of novel writing. Everyone always asks you what a novel is about. In the author's note that accompanied Life After Life, I gripe that it's about itself, and I didn't spend 2 years writing it in order to précis it in a couple of sentences. But of course it is about something. If you ask me that question about A God in Ruins, I would say that it's about fiction, and how we must imagine what we cannot know, and the fall of man from grace. There are, you will probably notice, a lot of references in the book to Utopia, to Eden, to an Arcadian past, to Paradise Lost, and Pilgrim's Progress. Even the book that Teddy's daughter, Viola, throws at his head at one point is Enid Blyton's The Land of Far Beyond, which is itself based on Pilgrim's Progress. So much of this is only semi-deliberate, as if there is a part of the writing brain that knows what it's doing and another part that is woefully ignorant. I see only now how much rising and falling there is in the text, everyone and everything ascending in flight or falling to earth, and the birds flock upon flock. Imagery is for me of paramount importance in a text. Not complex imagery that jumps up and down and demands to have its hand shaken, but a more subtle web that weaves its way throughout, often enigmatically, and knits everything together. The red thread of blood that binds the Todds echoes the red ribbon of the long leg to Nuremberg, that echoes the thin red cords of Teddy's sheltered housing. A pattern that I hadn't even noticed until the final read-through of the novel, and yet makes perfect sense to me now. Just don't ask me why there are so many geese. I have absolutely no idea. And of course, there is a great conceit hidden at the heart of the book to do with fiction and the imagination, which is revealed only at the end, but which is in a way the whole raison d'etre of the novel. I think that you can only be so mulishly fictive if you genuinely care about what you are writing. Otherwise you are occupying a two-dimensional space where the text ceases to be an interface between the self and the wider world. If this is a refutation of modernism or postmodernism or whatever has superseded postmodernism, then so be it. Any category designed to constrain should be thrown out. Constraint and restraint are words that appear continually throughout this novel, and their opposite, freedom. Something else I only realized when I had finished. I thought about taking them out, and decided against it. They're there for a reason. War is man's greatest fall from grace, of course. especially perhaps when we feel a moral imperative to fight it and find ourselves twisted into ethical knots. We can never doubt, ever, the courage of those men in the Halifaxes and Stirlings and Lancasters, but the bombing war was undoubtedly a brutish affair, a crude method employing a blunt weapon, continually hampered by the weather and lack of technology, despite massive advances that war always precipitates. The large gap between what was claimed for the results of the bombing campaign and what was actually achieved was never fully understood at the time, and certainly not, I suspect, by those men flying the bombers. The rationale behind the deliberate move away from attempted precision bombing of legitimate targets, near impossible at night with little technology, towards attacking the civilian population, was that killing the workers in the factories and destroying their environment was itself a form of economic warfare. It was a campaign that began with the best of intentions, to avoid the attrition of the First World War trenches, and yet it became itself a war of attrition, escalating all the time, an ever-open maw that could never have enough manpower, technology, raw materials, all of which might possibly have been more fruitfully directed elsewhere, particularly perhaps in those last months, almost apocalyptic for Europe, when Harris's obsession with pulverizing a dying Germany into annihilation seems more like a biblical punishment than a military strategy, although I am not one of Harris's detractors. Hindsight is indeed a wonderful thing, but unfortunately it is unavailable to view in the midst of battle. We have been plagued by questions about the morality of the strategic bombing offensive ever since the end of the war, aided perhaps by Churchill's diplomatic backpedalling from responsibility for the policy, and whether our war on savagery did not in the end become itself savage as we attack the very people, the old, the young, women, that civilization is supposed to defend. But the bottom line is that war is savage. For everyone, innocent or guilty. This is a novel, not a polemic, and I am no historian, and I have accordingly left the doubts and ambiguities for the characters and the text to voice. And as a final note, I'm sure that most readers will recognize that Augustus owes a debt to William Brown of Just William fame. Augustus is a poorly drawn shade of William, who remains for me one of the greatest fictional characters ever created. Richmore Crompton, I salute you.
This has been a Hachette audio production of A God in Ruins, written by Kate Atkinson, read by Alex Jennings, directed by Alexa Moore, recorded by RNIB Studios, post-production by RNIB Studios. A God in Ruins is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2015 by Kate Costello Limited. Audio production copyright 2015 by Random House Audiobooks. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook, without the permission of the publisher, constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.